This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
The following paper was given by Professor Michael McClure of the University of Western Australia for the Robertson College PIGU mini-conference on the 29th of November 2013.
So I'm talking about a particular aspect, I suppose, of PIGU and the question of the return to the gold standard. The question that I'm looking at in particular is his membership or his contribution to the Chamberlain-Bradbury Committee. He was invited onto that committee in 1924 by Otto Niemeyer. He's very famous in Australia for coming down during the Depression and telling us how we need to organise ourselves. Infamous, whatever. But anyway, he's on this committee, and so I'm trying in this paper to utilise some archival work I've been doing to try and get a better feel for what PIGU was thinking and what he was contributing. So there are a couple of general points. This committee itself was important historically because it's the forum that's recommending to Churchill that the gold standard is the right standard to return to. Niemeyer is actually asking him on to the committee, which, you know, we've called the Chamberlain-Bradbury Committee, but it's the committee to look at the currency and Bank of England note issues. You don't even have a sense from the title that that's its objective, is to look at the return to the gold standard. And even the letter inviting PIGU to join the committee is framed entirely in the question of whether the note issue should be amalgamated or not. Mm. So you don't have that clear sense early on that was their goals. Now, I stumbled across in the Marshall Library here an archive in their PIGU papers, four boxes this large, where PIGU's kept his personal copies of the documents which were distributed for the committee members to reflect on. And as he was unable to attend many of the meetings, he carefully went down and highlighted things that took his interest. Now, we don't know why it took his interest, because he might have violently objected to it or he might have violently supported it, but he's highlighted it, and so at least we know that the topic is of interest. Whether it's a positive or negative relationship, we have to infer. So what I've done in my paper, I've looked at three things. After providing some basic historical context, look at those transcripts of interview that he's highlighted and look for the context of the review, to look at his highlighting of issues that relate to transition, that is, how do we get to the gold standard, what are the issues that we need to focus on during that period of transition. And then I focused on another section of comments of issues that relate to things of an ongoing matter. If you're on the gold standard, if you're going to return to the gold standard, what issues do you need to consider? So I go through that in this paper, and then I ended up highlighting the recommendations of the committee and contrasting that with the nature of what PIGU had highlighted. And it emerges that there's, you know, what he's highlighted is subtlety and nuance and concern. The paper, which is the document itself, which is the recommendations of the committee or the report of the committee, sort of drafted by, you know, a Treasury member, Mr. Young, and people comment on that, but it's written in a very unequivocal and firm way, and you would have no sense of the type of considerations that went into preparing that document, at least from PIGU's side. So look at those briefly. And in the end, I try and think of the relevance of PIGU's work on monetary theory, particularly his paper on the value of money, for what that helped, whether the extent to which that helped him to come to a conclusion on whether you should or should not return to gold. I do that because I'm of the view that it's his position in the community as a monetary theorist at this stage that's getting him invited onto the committee. That paper was written in 1917, shortly after he was invited in the Cunliffe Committee, which is in 1918, which is looking at the end of the war and how to get back to a normal standing, and then again in 1924. So my goal there is to see whether there's anything that paper might tell us about how it affected PIGU's assessments of the future of monetary policy in the UK from 1925 onwards. the sort of conclusions that I reach are broadly that although Pigou highlighted nuance and he highlighted particularly people's ideas of a concern over transitional issues, I mean, the bulk of what he's highlighted is about transitional issues, not mm-hmm. the ongoing issue. And the people who are highlighting the transitional issues were by and large pointing to potential problems, that what you're going to have to go through to get them. These are things that he was highlighting. But my contention is that the monetary theory that he brought along, based on this, the value of money, essentially has the real sector treated as exogenous, and you know, the real value, real cash balances, you know, are some proportion of the total real sector that's put aside for property and cash balances, and that if there's a direction of causation, it runs from the real to the money, or at least, or it's inserted exogenously. Now he's concerned with all sorts of things which will cause that cash balance share to change, but there's not much which can help you look at the interdependence between the monetary sector and the real sector. And I think because of that, there's not much that his understanding of monetary theory would have brought him to make a decisive finding one way or the other on whether you should or you should not return to gold. And on that basis, he was inclined to support the prevailing inside wisdom, the bureaucratic wisdom of Treasury, the Treasury of the advice of professional bankers, either they central bankers or the industry committee in general. Okay, so the context to think about here is that the gold standard applied to 1914 when England went to war. It wanted to have capacity to influence monetary policy in a way which wasn't going to put fiscal stress on fighting a war, so Treasury was given the power to issue its own currency notes. That had occurred in 1914. At the end of the war, there was a decision, a view that we need to return to normality in some sense. That normality might be returning to the gold standard. It seemed to be the sense of the Cunliffe Committee, at least, and that was established in 1918. But there were issues about how to transition there. And that committee recommended that, firstly, we want to bring in the currency issue should at least be accounted within the Bank of England's banking department, so that is a common reference to looking at currency and banknotes going out into the UK. And secondly, there should be limits on the fiduciary circulation of currency notes. So currency notes, there's a fiduciary circulation which were... you know, if you presented it and said you want gold, you'd get gold, but there was no gold stock to cover it, and there was a component which did have a non-fiduciary component, which did have either backing of notes or backing of gold. Much of it was a fiduciary circulation, and the context that now is leading into the forming of the Bradbury and the committee, you know, the Chamberlain Bradbury committee, is that you've got a period of the issuing of those fiduciary notes is being restricted, so that the most that can be issued in any one year is the maximum from the previous year, and there's a graph, essentially the amount of issuing is going down, because prior to that period the amount of monetary issue had gone up dramatically. In the 2 years prior to the committee, though, we've got a period of fiscal problems, the budgets are in trouble, and you've got periods of deflation, and this is an environment that these considerations are going to be considered in. Deflation that's starting to diminish, but you've got real growth just starting to come back from a period when there was real a downturn. So the committee was formed in 1924. June 27th was their first meeting. And it becomes very clear early on that there's three questions that the committee is dealing with. The note amalgamation, which is evident from the title of the committee, the question. Second question is gold embargo. There's currently an embargo, or at the time there was an embargo, on the export of gold, which is set to expire on the 31st of December 1925. So there's this impending, there's sort of a guillotine ready to drop on a certain date, and so the question of whether you extend it, go early, or accept that embargo. The third question is whether you should return to a gold standard. And in fact, when you remove, if you remove the embargo, you've got there's an immediate question about the gold standard comes in, and it's sort of de facto way. But whether you want to defend it, commit to it, and you make. And the sub question here is whether you announce it and say this is what we're doing. Now, I was curious at the start. I thought that maybe the gold, return of the gold standard was a byproduct that really was about note amalgamation, and other things just got hijacked. That was a part of my thinking. Maybe got hijacked by Treasury or hijacked by the Bank of England. But that's not the case. Or from the discussions, all of them seem to accept that there's an agenda. That agenda is implicit in the Cunliffe Committee, and the question on how to return to the gold standard and the period in time that it would take is there. So there's it's raised in the context in the discussions and the like. So so those three questions are generally agreed by the members. Just in terms of timing, the dates when meetings occurred, when there were witnesses giving testimony, were June 27, 1924, when Pugu was there, and that was with Montagu Norman and Charles Addis. So these are Bank of England, the current governor and a previous governor. He was also there on the 25th of January 1925. This is after drafts of the report had been repaired, and they're interviewing the same people again, and Pugu's there. But when the committee met in July, it met on the 3rd, 4th, 10th, 11th and the 30th, mm-hmm. when it interviewed most people from the mm-hmm. industry, or when it interviewed people from former chancellors of the exchequers or advisors to chancellors of the exchequer, he was not there. But he did get those documents, the transcripts of those meetings, and went through them very carefully, and that's what I'm looking at. In regard to context, the three main contexts, I think, points that seem to be relevant to me were the framing of the implications of the Cunliffe Committee report and whether it had relevance to this committee, and in short, I'll just say yes it was and was discussed at various stages, and he's highlighting that. The second thing is the monetary system prevailing in 1914 versus the money system prevailing in 1924. And that particular question was one of the few times that he looked to theorists. So Keynes is making the point that there is actually quite a big difference between what occurred in 1914 and now, and that's to do with flexibility. After the Cunliffe Committee, you've imposed restrictions on the fiduciary issue, and that restriction is now operational. That is, you've actually reached the level where you can't increase it because the previous years has become the maximum. And you have a ban on trade in gold. You have also the non-fiduciary level fixed. So you're getting into an area which he's considering quite dangerous. So that's underlying, I guess, the importance of this committee at least coming to a decision which is going to do something and give some flexibility in monetary policy. The third contextual point is the war reparations payment. There was a default. Germany defaulted on war reparation payments, and French and Belgian troops entered the Ruhr Valley, and Dawes, an American senator, chaired an international reparations committee, and they came up with a plan that should be agreeable to Germany and agreeable to the Allies is for those war reparation payments to be resumed. The relevance of that issue to this committee was that there was a suggestion that the German mark might be pegged to the US dollar. The US dollar was effectively a gold standard dollar. There was a concern that, among some people, that other parts of Europe and America might be going on to the gold standard, and I'm not even British. fascinating discussion there with McKenna, and McKenna, probably there's three or four times as many marks on McKenna's papers mm-hmm. from Pugu than anyone else. So he's a very clear and interesting thinker, and it's attracted Pugu for, again, whether it's supporting or opposing, but what he says is attracting it. McKenna's take on it is that we wouldn't have the problem. The problem would be for the mark and the American dollar if they did that sort of thing. So, anyway, so that's the context, the historical context of the events that I've covered, which Nahid does much more fulsomely in the longer period, so she'll obviously talk about those sort of things. But that's the context, and the context of the committee was relatively non-controversial. They seem to agree with it and have a common goal as to where to go. Now, in regard to transitional issues, there's five issues that emerged as important there. One of them was the determinants of exchange, and a common theme revolving in the discussions of whether it's price levels that are going to determine the relative exchange rate, US and UK exchange rate, or whether it's other things, and particularly the role of sentiment. And sometimes reading the way the term sentiment's used, it may well be expectations. You know, can you play with interfere with expectations as a sentiment, might be the mechanism by which it's coming down, but it's an expectations sort of notion. Now, all of those discussions, there are US and UK-based, but I think underlying what's going on, there's an understanding that this is not a bilateral issue. And certainly the war reparations discussion gave me the impression that it seemed to be, at its broadest level, a multilateral question. If Britain goes, it's relative to US, it's its primary concern, but there are other levels that are being considered. In regard to the determinants of the exchange rate, you're getting statements from people like McKenna that it's all about prices, that prices determine relative exchange rates, and he and his profession sits there and monitors movements in prices in the UK. And in fact, in the archives, there's a graph of Irving Fisher's price indexes going over time and being plotted and transferred. So it's not only McKenna who does this, but it was people in the Treasury as well were monitoring what was happening in prices in other areas. And Keynes too makes a statement, if the criterion is not gold, I don't know of any other alternative which can be seriously put forward except the level of prices, and prices are being important. But the committee, in response to that, asks about sentiments. You know, is, for example, when talking to McKenna, is not the present level of the dollar exchange largely the result of sentiment? McKenna, no. He just continually insists that it's all about understanding prices. The second thing that's looking in the transition question is the timing of changes. That is whether you should have prior announcements and then what should you have first. You've got these three questions, the amalgamation question, the embargo on gold export question, and the actual commitment to going on a gold standard question. So that was an issue which received a lot of discussion. Particularly the chairman, so Chamberlain, and also Bradley, when asking questions, were really interested in the effect of announcements and sentiments, and they ask many people those things. When can and can't you ask things? When can you say things which will cause problems? And the key element there is problems will occur if there's an apparent commitment and there's a reneging on that commitment at a later stage. So it is a signal that they consider is important, so they'd rather you not do certain things if you can't do them. And two, if you're not going on gold, if the committee decides not to go on gold, they would like to get the amalgamation question sorted out straight away. So if that's the case, you can question of amalgamation can be sorted out. But if you are going on gold, that seems to be the last question that needs to be addressed, and how you get to gold needs to be addressed first. The effects on industry of a return to gold were discussed. So you've got industry and itself, so Federation of Industry and bankers saying that if you've got to have a change, it's got to be quick, one-off change is the way to go. Horn, a former Chancellor of the Exchequer, says the industry as a whole has to have effect. It should be a one-off effect. That's the easiest way to get there. But he then cites a famous Dr. Rumsford, who always managed to kill his patients and says, "Gentlemen, the operation has been entirely successful. Unfortunately, the patient has died in the course of it." And his Horn is quite worried that that's exactly what will happen to the British economy if you return to gold. So he doesn't fear, he fears that the English economy won't adjust to that standard. Then another point which comes out is how do outflows of gold be managed, and bank rate is used as one possible way. It's been discussed as a mechanism for trying to prevent an outflow of gold once the gold embargo is removed. The idea of, quote, dear money is sometimes seen as, you know, it might be necessary for a while, but in some cases, like Schuster, it's seen as and good enough, it's seen as an insurance. You know you've got it, you can fall back on it if you have to. And Schuster's saying even if you have this dear money, it shouldn't be to the level where it's going to affect profit, so that the long-term economic implications may not be so great. But these are all, again, things that Bagoo's highlighting. On the question of alternatives to the bank rate, he highlights a few. So restrictions on domestic credit. Again, this is a point of McKenna. He highlights that. I really like this, so if it's being recorded, I'll read it out. McKenna says, "What would be effective for the Chancellor were to announce this year that it is his firm intention to renew the embargo and that he was confident, sorry, not to renew the embargo, and that he was confident of the power of this country to resume gold payments. McKenna, I should liken him to King Canute, who has told the tide to recede." With a bit of a break. "You cannot get us onto the gold standard by any action of the Chancellor's restriction in any way. Nothing that he could do in the way of restricting credit here and forcing down prices in this country would get him to the gold standard. He would cause infinite trouble, cause unlimited unemployment, immense losses and ruin, but he could not balance his budget while he was doing it." McKenna, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, understands clearly the relationship between level of economic activity and the tax base, and he's saying that you knock one, you'll have a downward cycle where you cannot have access to the revenue you need to balance your budget. So the point he's saying is that McKenna is basically pro going on the gold standard in a very, very cautious, conditional way, but you have to be there. The conditions have to be right to get there. You can't make it. That's what he's warning. Restrictions on currencies was another possibility that was being discussed. Bagoo's highlighted McKenna's rejection of that as it just doesn't work. And also buying gold at a loss. That is, if you've got the outflow, the Bank of England maybe have to resort to buying gold at a loss. That's also mentioned. So they seem to be the main issues on transition that are discussed. The main issues of an ongoing nature discussed are as follows, and I'll do them quite quickly. The ongoing benefits of Britain of a return to the gold standard. The thing that strikes you here is that they're largely undefended, that they're implicit. The benefits are there, you know, they're just sort of, it's not a demonstrated benefit, but it seemed to be appropriate. The second point is the cost of returning, and this is, I found fascinating, the discussion of McKenna on America having to spend £60 million to engage in the price maintenance of gold. That is, 10% of the world's stocks of gold are based on the demand for gold as a commodity. 90% is based on holdings of banks. As America's on a gold standard, if the gold value of gold diminishes, its currency is going to depreciate, and you can't have that. So it's got this massive amount of money that it's buying, gold that it's buying to keep the gold price high. And then using his phrase, they're buying it and burying it. So they're sterilising the effect by bond trading, essentially take the money back out of the country. So they've increased the money supply by getting gold, and then they're taking the money out in through trading in bonds. Now, this, for McKenna, is a reason not to rush into anything. Let the Americans have that problem. They can keep spending it. The moment we decide to sign up, we're part of that deal. We'll be involved in this process. It's not a costless process. We have to be prepared to be involved. But again, these things are held, which was interesting. Next point is the general level of relationship between price levels, exchange and credit controls. It comes back to an issue there with Keynes. Keynes saying that the quantity of money being issued is not a very good way of controlling these things because it's the very last domino. If something's going wrong, it's going to flow through, and the last domino is your note issue. If you try and correct it at that stage, it's not going to be effective. So there's a lot of quizzing of Keynes on this, when you should have it, if you're going to have limits on issues of money, what those things would be. In his view, was they should be very, very liberal limits, because you don't want to be locked into not being able to get money out when you need. Okay. The next ongoing question is the amalgamation questions. Who should have the authority to issue sterling? The question raises is whether it's not a possible problem for an authority like a Treasury Department to have authority to issue money, and a separate authority like a Bank of England having the authority to issue it. And it seemed to be good to be out of the hands of the Treasury or possibly government. And the last point on the ongoing issues is the limits of the effectiveness of restricting amalgamated money. So you've got the Cunliffe Committee, which has a restriction on currency issues. Question now is, should you be having restrictions on the new amalgamated currency, in effect the currency notes issued under the authority of Treasury were withdrawn and just replaced by banknotes at the new £1 banknote had to be constructed. Here you get an interesting exchange with Bradbury and McKenna on the notional world and the world in which you are. And for him, there's all these sorts of subtle compromise. In this ideal world, you'd have everything just determined on prices. You wouldn't have a limit. But in the world in which you are, the world is not ideal. So McKenna's sort of accepting you have to make compromises, and Pigou's highlighting on this, that the world is not ideal, you have to do these sort of things. Okay, the committee itself, when it made its report, suggested that an early announcement to return to gold standard be made, and that be made clear that the prohibition on the export of gold, which was scheduled for 31 of December, would not be renewed. The gold would be traded from that point onwards. The report's very positive. It talks about, there's been the exchange has moved from 10 or 12% below parity at the start of the committee's meetings to only 1.5% below parity. So there's an expectation, and this comes through in some of the discussions, that the demand for pension payments for soldiers and et cetera in the US is putting pressure on the US budget. The expenditure is rising. It's likely that the relative level of inflation in the US is going to be higher than UK. So it may just be able to get to the gold standard without having to do any particular policy measure. Pigou gets a change to the draft to say that, in his words, the final report is adjusted so that Britain would have to expect a significant but small decline in domestic price levels. Even though they're only 1.5% below parity, seeing the price levels may need to change by up to 6%, which was not insignificant. So he wanted to have a statement in there saying that there may be some adjustment that has to go through. On the question of the amalgamation of currencies, that wasn't given anywhere near the urgency of the gold standard. And this is 1925, and that's saying let's do that in 1928. It's going to take a while to print these new notes. I don't know why it takes so long to print a new note. That was one thing. And the other thing is they wanted to see how the new system was going to operate before you started printing them. Okay, I'm not going to go into anything because of time. I'm not going to go into the relevance of the value of money. I'll leave that to discussion. And in the latter part, I'll just conclude. Pigou's attention to transitional issues was firstly thorough, and all of the points that he's highlighting issue caution, where things can go wrong. That's what he's highlighting. He seemed to be very focused on what can go wrong in the attempt to get there. When you look even at the long-term issues, it seems that his caution may have actually deepened. So he had to... again, he's focusing on potential problems that can occur. So even just a cursory glance with having to worry too much whether he's supporting an issue or opposing it will show that the nature of the issues he's highlighting are sort of nuanced and detailed and subtle, nothing like the actual nature of the report itself. So why did Pigou, sign up to the report? One of the things I've got here is a quote from Pigou cited in Muggeridge, where he's writing to Young, the secretary, says, on the main issue, which one of... Oh, no, yeah, I think it's from Sung. On the main issue, which is one of practical, political rather than economics, whether the government should take the plunge now and announce no renewal of the embargo, I'm only just, on balance, in favour of a wait-and-see policy. I read that to say I agree, basically, with McKenna, which is essentially his view, that a wait-and-see policy is appropriate. It would be inappropriate of me as an academic person to press for heroism, but if the rest of the committee has been in favour, I doubt if I should have opposed. So now Young can write the report knowing that it's not going to be opposed by Pigou. The idea in my take on this is his idea that it's inappropriate for an academic person to press for heroism is that really his understanding of the tools didn't give him a basis for taking a firm ground one way or another. So he didn't have the basis for taking a heroic stand. So in that he was inclined to then defer to the views of the other people on the committee. So when theory's indecisive, listen to the counsel of practical people.